AI is probably consuming your business and maybe even your personal life right now. There's no better person to help us carve a path forward than Paul Raitzer. Let's get on with the show. Hi, everyone. This is Mark Schaefer. We're going to do things a little differently today. Normally, our episodes are about 30 minutes, but after Paul Raitzer was done with our episode, I let the recording keep going to record some Q&A from people in my Rise community. And it was so good, I thought I would add that as bonus content today. I think you're going to really love the discussion about AI, how it impacts businesses, our careers, and what AGI means to our future. Enjoy the show. Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of The Marketing Companion, and we are going to have some AI fun today. Yeah, you think it's been fun so far? You ain't seen nothing yet. We're going to explode the fun today with my friend Paul Raitzer. Paul is the founder of the Marketing AI Institute. He has an unmissable newsletter, a highly fun and interesting podcast. And that is not to be missed. But Paul, before we get into today's show, I want to just mention our sponsor, because here's my prediction. I'm going to go down in the weeds with you. I'm going to forget to come up and talk about our sponsor. So I'm going to do it right now. And that, of course, is Brevo. They've been such a good sponsor, such a good company to us. And, you know, one of the things that a lot of small to medium-sized companies struggle with is CRM. Brevo's got a comprehensive CRM suite, tailor-made for businesses of all sizes. Even big companies like Michelin are using this thing. So with Brevo, you can address all your customer conversations in real time and create stunning marketing campaigns. You can get started for free. It's really amazing. Once you try it, you're going to love it. It's so simple to use. Go to www.brevo.com, Brevo is B-R-E-V-O, /marketingcompanion, and use the promo code companion to save 50% on your first 3 months if you decide to sign up. Now, Paul, I love all the content you put out there. And on the last show, you seemed a little frazzled, more frazzled than usual. You started the show saying, "This is insane." And you talked about how you had prepared a podcast episode with your co-host, Mike, and you basically had to scratch everything and redo everything because things are changing so fast in the world. And what I'd like to do is kind of take a different angle today. What I'd like to do is let's put ourselves in the seat of a small to medium-sized business who's just trying to figure this out. You know, what advice would we give someone trying to get a start on this and not be in that frazzled, insane kind of state that we all seem to be in today? What would be some practical first steps? I just created a new talk, so it'll be interesting to see if some of my ideas align with yours about what I was trying to do is take this insanity and kind of tether it to common business principles that aren't going to change. That's kind of been my, approach to the sanity. But let's start with you. Thanks for being here. And how do you advise small to medium-sized businesses right now? How do you get them into that first step?
Yeah, it's always great to be with you and the group. We talk to a lot of small businesses. I actually run AI workshops a lot of times with small business owners or marketers in the crowd. And what I basically teach people is not to get overwhelmed by the options. There are so many choices now. Even just if we think about language generation, ChatGPT, Anthropic Claude just yesterday announced their new language model. You have Google Gemini, you have Cohere, you have all these choices. And so we generally guide people is you just have to start and don't let all this choice lead to indecision and no action. And for me, the simplest way to think about it is, what are you already doing? Like, forget about all the other things that opens up the possibilities to do. Look at the projects, the campaigns, the responsibilities that you already have, and try and find ways at a task level that AI can help you. So I actually, I put this up on LinkedIn recently. As an example, we have our marketing AI conference in September. And so I build the agenda and recruit the speakers. And so we go through this process that's a big lift for me, because we also go through like hundreds of submissions of potential speakers. And so I just went into ChatGPT just to show people how I would do this and said, okay, you're in charge of building the agenda for this event. You have 100 submissions. You have to have 40 speakers. What are the tasks related to, you know, the identification and selection of speakers? And it spit out 17 tasks, like build it out. I said, okay, give me that in a CSV file. And it did. It created a CSV I could download. I then went through and assessed, could I use AI for any of these tasks? And I found basically there was roughly 220 hours of total work that I had projected, and that I could use AI for about 19% of that time. That there was all of these 17 tasks, there was like 9 of them that I could actually see using AI in some way to assist me. And by doing that, I could save an hour here, 2 hours there. That to me is like a super practical way to think about this. I'm going to do this anyway. I have to do these 17 things. Where in this process could I use ChatGPT or Gemini or Perplexity or whatever it is to help me be more efficient at the thing I know I already have to do?
Yeah, I think our views are very aligned in that way. Sort of my advice has been is like, look at what you're doing anyway, because innovation in the future will be applying a layer of AI to what we do. So if you're known to have great customer service, how can we be greater? If we're, you know, known for innovation, how could we be better innovators? If we're creative, how can we be more creative? And then apply that to these tasks as a first starting point. And the other thing, I like what you said, is push the edges. I think this is one of the biggest problems I see with everyone, even like students, business owners, you know, even, you know, experienced marketers right now, is they're using ChatGPT and Perplexity as sort of a new search site instead of really pushing the edges of what this can do. And in my new talk, I went through a litany of like just really crazy marketing activities that you can do with ChatGPT, just to give people an idea. Push the edges, master this thing. Don't just use it as a search engine. Look at everything that you do and learn a little bit about prompting and master this for your business. I think that's especially important for students. I did a guest lecture for Alabama, actually, University of Alabama last night. And again, I found most of the students were not using AI in much more of a way than a search engine. I said, look, your job when you get into the workplace, your first employer is going to ask you to do two things. What do we do about TikTok? And how do we get on AI? You've got to master AI. You've got to be pushing the edges of this thing every single day. So what about where do companies get stuck? Where are they stumbling right now? Is it the overwhelm, or is it the legal concerns? What's the bottleneck to progress?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely depends. So we work with some of the biggest companies in the world on this, like met with their executive teams and talk with their CIOs, CTOs, CMOs, CEOs. So at an enterprise level, there are challenges. And then at a small business level, there's some different challenges. So I'll kind of tackle both just for perspective.
Okay. Good.
So at the highest level in major enterprises, what's generally happening, again, I'll kind of focus on like large language models and writing platforms as kind of the main basis, because most generative AI things build off of those anyway. So what's happening is you have the CIO, CTO's office is working directly with Google or Microsoft or OpenAI in most cases to do enterprise level solutions. So they're going to buy thousands of licenses for like Microsoft's 365 Copilot or Google Gemini or OpenAI Teams. And so they're doing that and they're pursuing that, but they're not then enabling, like, say, the marketing team to go now, because the marketing team doesn't need the CTO or the CIO to tell them what to do. Like, there's hundreds of use cases for marketing. And so the marketing team just wants to go. Maybe they have 5 or 10 or 20 people that just want to get something and start. And so we're seeing a lot of, like, broad level CIO, CTO guiding big picture thinking and kind of macro solutions. And then you're seeing, like, the marketing department just saying, let's just go get 20 licenses to ChatGPT team and let's start doing that, or go get Jasper or Wright or whatever. So in a big enterprise, it's the challenges of, we have to get the solution, then we have to get it through procurement, we have to deal with security and concerns on the legal side. We don't have generative AI policies in place yet that dictate the use of these things. So it's just the usual slow transformation of a big enterprise that just kind of makes everything get bogged down. In the smaller businesses, and this is relatively true even in the big enterprise, there's just very few people who understand this stuff.
Yeah.
So lack of education and training, to me, is the number one obstacle in both big and small companies. Because to your point, Mark, it's like, someone goes in and plays around with ChatGPT, finds a few use cases for it, and then they mainly maybe focus on just that. And they're not pushing what's possible with it. They're not really exploring what can be done and sharing their prompts with other people on the team and really infusing it into the organization. So what we're seeing is just very low adoption levels, because it's very segmented right now who's actually experimenting with these tools and who is savvy with them to the point where they could actually teach other people in the organization how to use them. So mm-hmm. it's kind of like education, training, and change management are, to me, the biggest obstacles almost everywhere right now.
Yeah. And I think one of the lessons we could take from this is that you're not behind, right? Because I mean, right. So, I mean, I saw research just from a few weeks ago that showed, I think, the number one AI implementation. This was a survey of 3,000 different companies. The number one implementation, and that was only 27%, was employees dabbling. That's the breakthrough. Employees dabbling. I think the number was something like only 7% had actually implemented anything. So definitely we're not, you know, it's still early days.
Oh, I have one more thing there, Mark. So the other thing I'll see is, you know, I'll do a talk in front of 1,000 people and I'll say, who's used ChatGPT? Every hand goes up.
Yeah.
Who has ChatGPT Plus, like the paid version?
Yeah.
Just 90% of the room's hand goes down. And what I always tell people is, unless you're using the paid version, unless you have the version with computer vision built in where it can see things and understand images and analyze charts and build images and analyze data, like, you have no idea how capable these models are to transform knowledge work in their current form if you're not using the paid versions and regularly experimenting with those paid versions. If your only understanding of where we are today with AI is a free version of ChatGPT, that's like a 2022 understanding of, like, where we are today.
So I want to build on something that you mentioned. You talked about, well, an easy first step at the enterprise level is to buy licenses for something like Copilot. I have not tried Copilot yet because, you know, it's kind of expensive and, you know, the early reviews were kind of meh. I personally think this could be like the greatest thing that ever happened to me. If they could get Copilot right, you know, and I could say, hey, make me some PowerPoint slides. You know, I think it would just be dazzling. So in the early days of the internet, and I was there, you were not, I was, you know, look, it was scary because they said, you've got to learn to code. You've got to learn to code. If you are going to be relevant and you're going to be in this game, you got to learn to code. And my brain doesn't work that way. So I thought, oh boy, I am in for trouble. Well, it turns out I didn't have to learn to code because there were lots of ambitious people who were much smarter than me who did learn to code that made all these amazing apps. And now, I mean, the internet surrounds us like the air that we breathe. And, you know, it the internet comes to me. I didn't have to go to the internet and create my own stuff. So it occurs to me, that's what I think will be happening with AI. So, and I want to get your view on, do companies need to be like building custom GPTs? Is this a way that they're going to create competitive advantage, or is this just going to be redundant because the layer of AI is going to be embedded in every single software and app that they use on their daily jobs?
Yeah, I mean, it will be embedded. Like I'm a huge believer that, I mean, the number I'll throw out at times is 80% of what knowledge workers do will be AI assisted within 1 to 2 years in, you know, almost every aspect. And what I mean by that is HubSpot, Salesforce, Google, Microsoft, Adobe, Oracle, like they're all just going to build it all into it. Now, just because it's there doesn't mean people will know how to use it. So I still think there's going to be GPTs being built that are like custom to your internal workflows and processes and style guides and things like that. And that's what like a Jasper Writer enables now, where you can go in and kind of train the models on your style guides, your brand guidelines, your tone, things like that. And then when someone goes to use it, it's pre-trained on that content. So I think with it, with GPTs, you could start to see an example where, like, let's say you have a marketing team and you want to train them how to write a press release, just the simplest thing we could think of at the moment. Well, there's a certain style you're going to follow. Maybe it's an AP style writing, but you're going to have a format you use within your company to do these press releases. So you could build a GPT that's pre-trained. Here's 20, you give it 20 examples. This is what they should look like. This is the tone and the style. Here's how our quotes are structured. And so when you then assign a marketing associate to write the press release, they're just going to start. And so rather than starting with a blank page or saying, hey, here's three examples, you've already cut all that work out because you trained a GPT on how to write a press release using human language. Like you didn't have to code anything. You just go in and say, here's our format, here's examples, boom. And now you have a GPT press release writer. And so I could see like in companies, large and small, there's all these internal processes that people are supposed to follow. And as leaders, we just give them examples and say, just do it like this. The GPTs, the templates within these models are going to enable us to really fine tune that process, streamline the efficiency of the process, and give professionals a much easier way to kind of follow structures and systems within companies. So even in that sense, they're going to be great, in my opinion.
Yeah, I can't wait, you know, and that was the result of some of the research. I mean, it was done by Microsoft, so I put a little bit of grain of salt on top of this. Yeah. But, you know, they said, look, there's some fear about AI replacing jobs, but overwhelmingly, employees are really excited about getting rid of administrative tasks and getting help with creative tasks. And certainly that's my view. Well, putting ourselves back in the role of a leader of a small to medium-sized company or even a large company that really wants to embrace this, what advice do you give people in terms of handling the overwhelm? I mean, sometimes it's just dizzying, and in our community of Rise, I mean, people are just, you know, posting links of new developments and new ideas every day. And, I read most of it, but I mean, you could just spend your whole career just really keeping up with every nook and cranny. As you opened in your last podcast, you just said, look, this is just insane. So what, you know, we're not built for this, and bureaucratic organizations are not built for this. So what's your advice in terms of managing this in a reasonable way to stay sane?
I don't advise doing what I do, which is like 24 hours a day of trying to process all this for 13 years. Like it's a lot to consume. And especially if you allow yourself to wander into like the what happens when kind of theories, and you start to process all the big things that are going on with misinformation and synthetic media and deepfakes, like it is a lot to deal with. So what I generally tell people is like, be a specialist in your area. Like the thing that remains uniquely human, in my opinion, and this is, it's a kind of a moving target for me, but like domain experience, expertise, intuition, like you have to have those things to work well with AI. AI can create outputs for you, but expertise, experience, intuition are critical to know if that output is any good. Mm. So like if I asked it, an example I like to use is like, my friend runs a dental practice. He owns a dentistry. he came to me a while back and he's like, I'm getting crushed, man. Like my profits are down because the insurance company controls what I can charge for things. Inflation is up. So like, I'm getting crushed. And so I went into ChatGPT-4 and I said, you own a dental practice. Here's the situation. How can I leverage AI to maintain or increase my profits despite inflation and rising costs? It came out with 10 things he could do. I had no idea if those 10 things were viable. I'm not a dentist.
Yeah.
So I sent it to him though. And as a dentist, he was like, oh my God, there's like 3 things on this list I hadn't even thought about. Like this could make my profits. Like this is incredible. So it's that his expertise and experience as an entrepreneur and as a dentist is what enables him to take the output. So the way I think about this is we still need experience. We still need expertise. We still need to do the hard work of learning how to be the expert on a topic. Like AI can't shortcut becoming an expert at something. This is kind of the theme of my AI for Writers Summit keynote. We write for our audiences to achieve outcomes with our audiences, but we also write for ourselves because we clarify things. We establish points of view. Like we learn and think through writing. Mm-hmm. And so that to me is where people should focus is how can I enhance my own experiences and expertise through AI as an assistant to me. And let me focus on being a better advertiser, a better brand marketer, a better communication specialist, like whatever it is, focus on AI's value in that domain. And then if you're interested in all the stuff on the outskirts, all these other things that are going on, by all means, go learn them the best way you do through podcasts, books, courses, whatever it is. But right now, focus on applying it to what you do and giving yourself superpowers, basically, in your domain.
Well, if you need a human testimony for your writer's workshop, I can supply that because I've been working on a new edition, a third edition of a book I wrote called Social Media Explained.
Oh, yeah. Nice.
And when I write a book, it just totally exhausts me. I mean, literally, physically, I'm like physically ill by the time I'm done writing a book because it consumes me and it obsesses me. So I thought, you know what? There's got to be a better way. I'm going to embrace everything that AI has got. I'm going to write an AI assisted book. And it was a total flop. And the reason is because, you know, AI, you know, it wants to please you and find the right answer. And it looks through all the millions of data points through history. And the algorithm gives us the probability of the best answer. And if that's the information you want, then go to Google. A book has to be insights. It's like you said, it's the intuition. It's the insights. It's connecting the dots in the new way, in different ways. It's my stories, my experiences, the mistakes I made, the revelations I've had that helped me do social media in a different way. It's projecting where all this is going to, you know, end up, connecting the dots. So it was a total flop. I just ended up, you know, doing the old school writing again because it was just not up to my standard.
Yeah. I think that's what I always tell people is the natural instinct is to assume AI is a replacement to writing. And I actually think it's the least interesting thing it does. Like I use it for summarization. I use it to ideate. I do use it to develop outlines. I use it to explore concepts. Like at the end of the day, though, like I still want to do the writing because if I'm going to stand here unscripted and have a conversation with people about a topic, it's like reading the cliff notes and thinking you can explain a book. Like it doesn't work. Like you still have to do the hard work. And this is like, even for our podcast, like I probably consume, I don't know, 40 to 50 pieces of AI content a week at minimum. And that's videos, podcasts, books, articles, whatever. The ones we pick to talk about on the podcast, I could very easily go into Anthropic or ChatGPT and say, write me a summary of this New York Times article. Just give it the copy and it'll do it.
Yeah.
Well, would I understand the article if I did that? No, because the thing that may be the linchpin to the entire article, it may not include in the summary, but I may read that and be like, oh my gosh, like that actually changes my whole perspective of this article.
Yeah.
And so you have to develop that. You have to do the hard work. Like it's not a shortcut for that.
So, and I want to go off script here a little bit because there's something there was a little thing that you noticed that I also noticed. This nuance that you would not have found in a summary of the news about AI. And it's this. There was that YouTube video of Sam Altman right before he got fired at OpenAI. Hmm. And in that interview, he said, I had the great honor of witnessing, you know, a lifetime event, a lifetime revelation. And I thought, they're there. He must have had a glimpse of AGI. Mm-hmm. And so, like, what's your bet?
On if they achieved AGI?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, do you think that, are we reading the tea leaves right on that one?
It's a really complicated topic. I do think that OpenAI and others are further along than the general public would believe that they are. I think there was probably some breakthroughs last year. I think GPT-4 is way more advanced than people understand. I've listened to some interviews with people who are on the red team for the original version of GPT-4 that we all didn't get. Because you got to keep in mind, GPT-4 was in safety, like red teaming in safety building for 7 months before it came to the public. So that model was done. And then they let a very select group of people explore what it was capable of. So it's called like a red team. And it could do some pretty insane things that they put guardrails in that you and I can't get it to do now. Mm-hmm. But like there was one guy who pleaded with OpenAI to destroy the weights for the original model because he became so concerned with its capabilities, and they did not do that. But that was GPT-4. GPT-4 was built. So that came out in March of 2023. So it was done around September, August 23, and it was already had been in training for over a year. So that model is like 2.5 years old. Mm-hmm. They didn't stop developing. Like whatever GPT-5 is going to be insanely advanced. And just yesterday we saw an example with Claude 3 where they gave it, they inject something to try and like throw it off. They'll ask it to like extract a piece of knowledge from, you know, a, I don't know, 100,000 words or whatever it is. And not only did it find the thing, it said, "You're testing me." Like it perceived that that thing was so out of the ordinary that it was being tested by someone, which makes the people even doing this step back and say, "Hold on a second. Like, does it actually understand it's being tested, or is somehow in its training data it like extrapolates that this is a test and it's just saying that?"
No, but so, still, that's that the initiative of saying,
"Correct,
you're testing me," is a little spooky.
Yeah, I think we're a lot closer than people would want to believe.
Yeah, I think so too.
And I think there's going to be a few things that'll come out probably in the next couple months that will make it a little more obvious of where this is going. The key is mathematics and reasoning. Like once these things are really strong at mathematics and reasoning, then everything changes. And even Sora, like the model from OpenAI that came out a few weeks ago, there's something about that that's very bizarre. And like, I don't know how long you want to spartan this, Mark. I'll take 2 minutes and just kind of give you the... There are people within the AI community who think you can scale up language models and get to AGI. There are some researchers who think language is it. There are others like Jan LeCun, who runs AI at Facebook, who believe they need a world model. They need to learn like a toddler does, where they just observe the world around them and they understand physics and they understand what's going to happen based on an action will cause a reaction. And they think that they need those world models to become AGI. Sora appears to be uncanny at its ability to generate things that follow the laws of physics. That's very weird. Like you shouldn't be able to give a prompt to a machine that hasn't been taught how to follow those laws. And it just does it. Like NVIDIA builds these engines that enable that to be coded into video games. Like the way video games follow the laws of physics is because they code them to. Mm-hmm. These things are just like outputting images that follow these laws. And mm-hmm. if you can create something that can understand and follow the laws of physics, then it changes a lot of things, because now they can create all this synthetic data that can then train these models to do all kinds of stuff. So I think we're closer than people would want to believe.
Yeah, I think so too. I think, you know, once people start getting a glimpse of what's really happening, it's it's going to change the world in a lot of strange ways. Yeah. Well, look, you know, my prediction was right. I did enjoy going down into the weeds with you. And yes, I totally would have forgotten to mention my sponsor. So that was a good decision to do that up front. And look, you know, and you know, if you're new to the podcast, I might remind you of the format that I have. Six rotating co-hosts. So Paul will be back in a couple months. And that also means if you're pitching me to be on the show, I don't have guests on the show. So stop pitching me. So anyway, but Paul will be back in a couple weeks. And thank you so much, because I feel like the conversation was just getting started. And thanks everyone for listening to the show as we head into our 12th year of the Marketing Companion. We will see you next time. Hey everyone, thanks for listening to the show. We're now going to open up the mics to Q&A from the studio audience. These are people from my Rise community. Anybody can join Rise. If you're interested, just shoot me an email, mark.schaefer@businessesgrow.com. Here we go.
This is Aaron Hassan of AH Marketing. Thank you for being with us today. I had a question. I've been talking to students at university recently and just instructing some classes. And I know they're concerned about AI and as they get into the job market. So I wanted to ask you, you mentioned that it's really important to bring your domain experience, expertise, and intuition to AI to compete today. So how can entry-level to mid-level marketers compete for new jobs in an AI future? Are new marketers doomed?
Yeah, so I spent a lot of time thinking about this. I have a 12-year-old and a 10-year-old, so I think a little longer term about their outcome. But I just spent 2 days at Ohio University running AI days for their faculty and staff and alumni and students. And I spent a lot of time talking with administrators and professors and teachers. To me, the really interesting thing is, how do we develop domain expertise and experience and intuition when you don't have to do the work we all did to get where we are? Like, we did the repetitive data-driven tasks, as unpleasant as they often are. It's how we develop the expertise. So I don't know how exactly it occurs, but I like to look at the parallel of chess and the game of Go, two games where AI has been superhuman for probably 8 to 10 years. And what you find with those players is they become even greater. Like, the greatest players in the world learn from the AI. They learn how it makes moves, makes decisions. And I think what may actually happen is, if AI is infused in the right way into training, into the workforce, it can actually accelerate the gain of experience and expertise and intuition by being there as an on-call 24/7 advisor trainer. So anytime I'm doing this, is how I teach my 12-year-old now, when she's doing stuff for school and I'm teaching her how to use Perplexity, like instead of Google in many cases, I'm teaching her to use it as an accelerant to her learning, not as a, here, it's going to do the answer for you and do the hard work. It's like, I want you to know how the machine thinks about this, and I will teach her exercises to go through to learn how to learn from the AI. And so it's going to take a change in the way education is done. It's going to take a change in the way management within companies is done and professional development is done. But I think there's ways to augment learning and accelerate it with AI as a coaching assistant, in a way.
Frank Prendergast here, and I had a question around, you know, yourself and Mark were talking about how close we might be to AGI, and I was thinking about the Elon Musk suing OpenAI and the fact that he's actually claiming that they've achieved AGI. Now, his motivations might be economical or competitive, but I'm wondering, I guess, two things. What are your thoughts? Because you mentioned that, like, GPT-4 might be a lot more powerful even than we get to see. So what are your thoughts on, like, how, you know, could it be an early form of AGI? Could it be defined that way? And also, it's now possibly going to be up to a court to decide that. are they going to be able to, and are they possibly going to define it in a way that the industry might not?
Yeah, it's so I think the court case is going to get thrown out. Personally, I mean, I think it's really more of a PR thing than anything at this point. But Elon and Sam have a very long, complex history together that I think has led to this moment. The AGI claims made within the lawsuit are largely related to Microsoft's own paper that called it Sparks of AGI, basically. That Microsoft's researchers who were using the unedited version of GPT-4, that they saw some things in this model that we previously haven't seen, some advancements in reasoning and understanding and things like that. So I think that it's possible we may get some legal definition of AGI out of this because they all kind of define it differently. I don't think anything's really going to come of this lawsuit. There's a chance it accelerates enough that there's discovery, which would be fascinating to hear whether or not OpenAI thinks it's AGI. I'm sure that has been talked about internally. But, you know, I think there's one of the best examples I've seen of AGI, and I'll grab a link when I stop talking here. There's a company called DeepMind, which was founded in 2010. It's a London AI research lab that was acquired by Google. And then now its co-founder, Demis Hassabis, runs AI at Google. His other co-founder, Shane Legg, did his PhD paper in like 2007, 2008 on AGI. And Shane just recently came out with sort of a degrees of AGI. And I think it's a really good way to think about this of like, how it's not going to be like we flip a switch and all of a sudden AGI is just everywhere in society. It's going to probably be more of a slow takeoff that'll feel more like full self-driving has, where it's just, it's kind of there, but it just sort of evolves and we have time to adapt to it as society. So Shane has a really good way of sort of categorizing the way to think about AGI. And I would maybe reference that because it's just such a fuzzy term. It's like, you know, at or above human level at most cognitive tasks. Like, what does that mean? Like, it doesn't, it's not tangible to any of us.
Yeah. Like, I mean, I think it might be, you know, we'll know it when we see it. I mean, that's one of the things that I've thought about is the general population, they're not going to care what test this thing has passed. If it freaks you out because it's so human-like, that's probably going to be, the public test anyway.
Dave Berger here. Thanks for doing this. You mentioned that there's a need out there for education among the general population. Do you think for someone to be an AI educator, they have to have a background in AI, like a degree? I mean, it seems like there's so much information out there on the web and it's changing so fast every day. Is it just something about, you know, just keeping up with everything? I mean, is it possible to just sort of be self-taught at this point?
I'm a journalism school major. So I ran a marketing agency for 16 years before I sold it, but I just started exploring AI in 2011 out of a curiosity and like, what was the story? What was it? How could I apply it to business, to marketing? And so for me, it was just self-exploration of like, what is possible? What is this tech and where's it going to go? And what I found was, the AI people, the technical, you know, AI researchers, machine learning engineers, they were generally not very good at communicating to non-technical people what it was they were building and what it was capable of. And so over time, I found myself to become sort of a translator of like, what were they actually building? When they make these crazy announcements, does this actually mean anything to any of us? And so over time, I was just able to sort of, I guess, understand what they were saying and make it make sense to non-technical people. So I always approach this, what is the story of AI? That when we built our AI Institute, the whole premise was let's tell the story of AI to non-technical people. Now we had to be tech savvy and like understand their world to do that. But I didn't go back and get a degree in anything related to AI. So I think it's really critical for AI literacy to be spread across society that we have really smart people in different disciplines who can understand AI and explain to doctors, to accountants, to lawyers, to like, we need to bring this knowledge to all these different people. And sometimes being an accountant who understands AI is better than being an AI person who's trying to explain to an accountant what's going on. And so I feel like we need AI expertise developed within each industry who can then kind of be voices within that industry to help them understand what's happening.
Hi, Paul. Thanks. Renee McIntyre. So I also have two daughters, 11 and 7. And when you were talking about your kids, like, I think it's great to think about being an accountant who understands AI. What do you see for kids this age, for the next generation? Like, where should they be focusing? What do you see as the next careers? What skills do you think are going to be most important? And what should they not be focusing on?
Yeah. It's really important questions. I'll give you the best answers I have, but I haven't necessarily solved this yet. So the way I think about the world right now is I'm fairly confident that I have a decent understanding of what's going to happen in the next 12 to 18 months. Like when you project out where these models are likely going to go, what they're expected to be capable of, if you gave me any industry, any career path, I could probably make a reasonable assumption of what that job looks like 12 to 18 months from now. If AGI is achieved, all bets are off. Like I can't even wrap my head yet around what that means. I'll put a quote from Sam Altman in a minute to explain why. What I think, again, if my daughter was entering freshman year of college right now, she's not, thank God. She's going to be a seventh grader next year. But if she was, I would send her to a liberal arts school. I don't think computer programming is going to be a thing. Like I really we have pushed so many people into computer science and programming. We're already seeing that human language, not code, is going to be the programming language of the future. And so I think all of us will be programmers. Like we will be able to just use our words to build whatever you can imagine. And so I think, but again, like I think there's room for people who are experts in that to have superpowers. But it's going to democratize the ability for so many other people to become developers and builders that I just don't know that that degree is going to be worth what it used to be. Time. What I think matters is an understanding of humanity and across, I don't care if it's philosophy or sociology or English or like whatever the major is. I feel like the more broadly you understand society and the more broadly you can play a role in coping with the impact AI will have across all these different disciplines, I think that that gives you a better chance of to be adaptable as we start to figure out what this means to like the workforce. That's my main thing is I think liberal arts degrees are going to take on greater value moving forward because we just need diversity of knowledge and experience to be able to adapt.
Yeah, I was reading... they're talking about that's one of the disconnects between developers who are just kind of developing this to push it to see how far they can take it. They said they really need to have some perspective of history and the arts and philosophy and maybe even theology to really guide.
Ethics.
Yeah, ethics. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Scott Scowcroft. And I guess my question is a follow-up. A little bit to your wonderful admonition for people to get liberal arts education. But I lost my cultural innocence, I think, when the Arab Spring failed. I really put a lot of stock into that. And so now I'm looking at AI, and there are a lot of promises for AI, but I'm wondering if something similar might go ahead and happen. What makes you think that we should be optimistic about the future, and might not the bad guys be able to, in their domains, be more powerful and take over using AI?
Because I wouldn't sleep at night if I wasn't. I mean, like, I honestly don't know. Like, there's going to be a bunch of crazy stuff that happens, and there's going to be a lot of bad actors, and there's going to be, I don't know about the doomsday scenarios, but it's going to get weird. Like, fast. And the only way I go to bed at night is because I think we still have agency in this. Like, I think we still get to decide how this plays out. And like, if you go back to 93, 94, Mark was referencing like the takeoff of the internet days, And someone said, there's going to be a dark web and people are going to do crazy stuff on this dark web. If you create this internet and you let it spread throughout society, like all kinds of horrible things are going to happen. And you know what they did? And they still do. And yet we're still here. And like, historically speaking, we're in pretty good shape versus like what our ancestors had. Like life's pretty good despite the mainstream media headlines. Like, and so I just choose to believe that somehow humanity figures this out and we come out net positive, because otherwise I might as well just stop what I'm doing and go get a bunker with Sam Altman and the rest of them.
I think there was a quote. I want to say it was from Mustafa Suleiman. I think he was behind DeepMind too, right?
He was one of the co-founders.
Yeah. And he's the Perplexity guy now, I think, if I recall correctly.
Yes, with Reid Hoffman.
Yeah. You know, he said in an interview, he said, look, you know, what's the most terrible invention in the history of the world? It's, you know, the atomic bomb. And, you know, we've been able to keep it in check. And he used that as an example to say, you know, we'll be able to keep, you know, AI in check as well. So that was his message of hope.
Yeah. He has The Coming Wave is his book, which is good read. I mean, the way I think you have to understand this is like everybody's got an agenda. Anyone who claims that this is the death of society and humanity and they're 100% confident in it, they have no idea what they're talking about. Like they're overconfidence. They're to an extreme. And anyone who says we have nothing to worry about, the EAC people, which is a whole like cult that's been building. Mm-hmm. They're the other extreme of like, just let it go. Like it'll figure itself out. And it's kind of like politics. Like the extremes do no one any good, either side of the extremes. Like you got to kind of find your own middle ground of like what you think is possible. And don't get paralyzed by either extreme, because there's reasons that they're on the extremes, basically.
Hi, Paul. Brian Piper.
Hey, Brian.
Good to see you. I know you have a lot of resources on your site, but what advice do you have for institutions or brands looking to set up AI governance policies? And did you ever do your custom GPT?
Not yet. The policy one. I mean, honestly, what most organizations need, because you can't find consultants for this stuff, like it's really hard to find people who actually know what they're talking about. You need people to raise their hands internally who want to become kind of the internal go-to on this and go take the online courses, go look at the example policies and figure out what's going to work for that organization. So oftentimes what I advise, I mean, if you are a consultant or have an agency or something, like we need people who figure this stuff out. Like I get asked a couple times a day to do consulting work and we don't do it. So we need people who can help guide organizations how to do human-centered AI within their companies and then deal with all the change management that's going to be required to figure this out. And that's where I see the biggest gap is I've talked with Fortune 50 brands, and they haven't even thought about a change management plan yet. Like they're just still trying to figure out which pilot projects to run. And so I think we're going to have this moment, like, you know, 12 months from now, 18 months from now, where it's almost like the ChatGPT moment where, oh my gosh, we all have generative AI in our companies now and no one thought ahead of what does this mean for our people and our operations and our tech. And it's going to be sort of this wake up call again.
Well, thanks so much for being with us today. Yeah. A delight and an inspiration as always. And I'm sure most people here, they're following you on your weekly epistles. So hang in there, man. Thanks for all you do.
Appreciate it.
All right. Take care.
Thank you.